Right, we are recording. It is Monday the 22nd of October 2018. I am Patrick Crozier and I am joined by Brian Micklethwaite.
How do you do?
And we're going to talk about, well, I thought it was how Britain chose its successor, but it's actually going to be the importance of being number three.
Well, it's more the generalised version of the British decision to choose America over Germany in the 20th century. It's not the only example of such a decision. It occurred to me that there have been others of the same kind, and I think you can probably think of more. And they happen all the time in politics when you get three political parties, and number three gets to decide what the coalition consists of.
Well, let's start with what Britain did in the 20th century. I mean, perhaps I could outline it because I think I know what you say. It is the fact that Britain was in a situation, perhaps not realising this situation, was in a situation where it was going to get overtaken. It was going to get overtaken by both America and Germany. This is the 1900 perspective. And the Britain, you say decided, I dispute the word decided, but, well, let's use the word decided for the time being, decided that America was going to be...
Yes,
America was going to be top dog.
It began with a decision that we were going to resist Germany, as we saw it.
Yes.
Whether that's true is another argument, but the British decided to fight the First World War against Germany. This leads directly on from the conversation we had about World War One, how it started and why it persisted. And your answer to the question, why did the British fight, was that basically the Germans couldn't be trusted to keep their word and stick to treaties that they'd undertaken to accept.
Mm-hmm.
And that therefore they were, you know, diplomatically speaking, the Antichrist, because they were powerful and untrustworthy.
Yeah.
And this was a lethal combination which simply had to be resisted.
I mean, they were also a direct threat to the
to the British Empire, and all that.
Of Britain.
Britain. So. But just the Empire, I think, as well, especially that. Anyway, Britain's position as number one entity in the world, great power in the world. And I agree with you that this wasn't made, this decision to fight against, to resist Germany, wasn't made in with the attitude of we're now going to pick who's going to succeed us. That wasn't what they were doing. But by 1940, it had sort of become clear that this is what we were doing. And certainly as the Second World War went on, it became clearer and clearer that that's what we had done. I mean, think of the fighting in 1944 when I remember reading that Buckingham Palace was sending desperate telegrams to the British Army saying, look, you're killing all the Debs' husbands, you know, because on the Western Front...
No, I said
1944, when they were marching into Germany.
Yeah.
Those fights in that part of Europe between Germany and Britain are always, as you keep insisting, very bloody affairs.
Yes, they are.
And we just didn't have enough blood. Or we thought we didn't, we felt we didn't. The Americans did, and it was as if we made most decisions you like to think in life you make by deciding at the start and then you implement them. But actually, it's very common in personal life and in life generally and public life for decisions to be made and then you realise what you've done. You've just allowed it to develop like that, and then you realise, oh dear, I've decided to live this sort of life.
Mm.
But I didn't really think about it at the start of the process.
No.
But by the end, you realise that's what you've done.
Yes.
That's the sort of decision it was, and it's a very common kind. And quite simply, if the British had not made this decision, we would now be living in a profoundly different world to the one we are living in. It's interesting to speculate what the Americans might have done if the British had taken a completely different turn.
Mm. Yes, I wonder what that sort of tone might have been. I mean, it would have been sort of standing aside in 1939, for instance.
Well, would there have been any 1939? I mean, we just don't know. It's such a big what-if if the British hadn't fought the First World War that it's all up in the air what would have followed. But the Americans would still have been a great power, even if they'd had no part in the First World War, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
And even if there'd been something resembling a Second World War, they'd had no part in that. They'd still be a force to be reckoned with. More the kind of force that they were when the Japanese declared war on them. That's to say, a force that consisted of huge industrial excellence, which at any moment could be cashed in for military excellence, or military effectiveness anyway.
I'm sorry, Brian. I'm trying to keep up with you, and I'm struggling here.
Well, the point is that the Americans might not have militarized in the 20th century the way they did.
Wouldn't they?
They might not have done.
You think they could have stood aside?
Well, there's not a lot of Americans wanted them to, didn't they?
Yes.
So yes. It might have happened. They would have just let the Germans and the Russians and perhaps the British, you know, slog it out in the world island and would have remained aloof.
Mm.
Or tried to. And they might have regretted it. They might have felt, working out very nicely.
Hmm. Yes.
But I mentioned the Americans. I don't want to make it sound like they had no part in the matter. They clearly, they went with the decision that Britain made. I'm still a little puzzled as to what Roosevelt was thinking when he was so determined to get his country into the Second World War. Was that based on a judgment that Hitler was a global threat to America?
This is something I'm not entirely sure about. This is to do with Lend-Lease, is it, and things like that?
Well, it's more to do with, for example, why was Roosevelt trying as hard as he could to inveigle America into the Second World War, despite apparently public opinion being set against it? He was promising we're going to keep America out of the war, but he was all the time trying to get it into the war as best he could within the limits of politics. Why?
And this took the form of...
Well, it took the form of when Hitler finally committed one of his classic blunders, one of many, of declaring war on America with apparently no conception of what he was doing. Roosevelt immediately said, "You're on." And from then on, the Americans made it their business to win the war in Europe before they won the war against Japan, which is a bit surprising.
Apparently there's a school of thought which says that Japan only entered the war when Germany said it could. It's not... There was some method in Germany's madness, shall we say.
Got it, yeah. I wouldn't be surprised. Hitler underestimated America horribly. But even that, yes, I suppose once the Japanese had attacked America, but the Americans might at that point have said, right, we're going to sort out the Japanese.
Yes, yes.
Germany's declared war on us, big deal. We declared war on Germany in 1939, didn't have any immediate consequences. So why should that have had any consequences?
Yeah.
They might have not, so to speak, enacted the what I've been calling the British decision to back them. They might not have tried to be number one militarily. They might have felt that becoming number one was better accomplished by remaining a commercial power. And of course, we are both members of a political movement, the Libertarian Movement, which contains many people who thinks that would have been a far better outcome. Certainly for America, and perhaps even for the world. Because after all, the World War II was a pretty bloody business, wasn't it?
Yes.
One thinks of our mutual friend, certainly my friend, Christian Michel, who, right in the middle of Europe is where he grew up and spent his working life, now lives in London. He's adamant that it was a crazy thing for the British to get dragged into this thing, and that whatever happened on the continent could hardly have been worse than what did happen. Personally, I'm now changing the subject wildly. Speaking as an ex-libertarian apparatchik with a title, you know, editorial director of the Libertarian Alliance, one of them, I was always very careful, or I tried to be, to distinguish between my personal opinions about history or about art or culture or anything from libertarian opinions, and to acknowledge the existence of libertarian opinions that were not the same as mine necessarily. I just don't know what would have happened if Britain had stayed out of the First World War. But there are probably plenty of libertarians who think it's a good thing we plunged in, and plenty of others who are adamant that we shouldn't have.
We've had that debate.
The older I get, the more I say to myself, it's hard enough to work out what the hell did happen without fretting about what should have happened.
Well,
that's
yes,
another.
Indeed. You can argue about principles, I suppose, and what the actual threat is, whether us libertarians should be backing the state when it starts to engage in this.
Mm. Well, in a sense, libertarianism is like the number three deciding between states. You know, who are the number two and the number one in a conflict, deciding whether to back one or the other. And the socialists had the same problem, didn't they? They've always had that problem. In the First World War, most socialists backed their national governments in national wars.
Yeah.
Lenin was remarkable in not doing that.
Well, certainly members of the British Labour Movement who were very unkeen on it.
Mm.
Yeah, that's true.
Anyway, the British decision became pretty firm, didn't it? I mean, it grew in its, you know, all through the 30s and then all through the Second World War, they were thinking, did we do the right thing? Yeah, we did.
This is the decision to go to war in 1914.
To allow the Americans to eviscerate the British Empire.
Well, this wasn't happening in the 30s, was it?
Well, in the 40s it was happening. During the war, yes. It was happening.
Yes.
Just let them do it.
I'm not vague, not up on this. So, in what way was the British Empire eviscerated during the First World War?
During the Second World War. Roosevelt was no friend of it, was he? I mean, he kept on saying, this is... This war is about ending all kinds of imperialism, starting with Germany and Japan, but the clear implication was that the British Empire would not emerge from it fighting fit. And Churchill went along with that, because he of all people understood the nature of the decision he was making, and often had sleepless nights about whether it was the right thing. And of course, all mixed up with that was the question of whether you supported the USSR against Nazi Germany, which also... He famously fell into depression about it.
Did he? Oh, goodness.
Well, I believe after the war,
he
wondered about whether this was the right thing to do. I don't think he had any serious doubts, but I think when he was in the grip of one of his black dogs, that's the sort of thing he would be thinking about.
Right.
But once he recovered his calm or his happiness, he would say, no, it was the right thing, it had to be done, or something.
Well, I'm struggling to think of alternatives to what Britain... Mm.
Well, he did.
I mean, the whole business of going to war in the first place was, as you said, the fact that Germany violated its own agreements. It did.
Well, as you
said,
I was just quoting you, because that was your answer to my question, what were the British thinking in 1914?
So I think that's the essential thing, and Germany is a dangerous enemy. It's not one you can easily ignore. Britain, I don't think, can easily ignore.
There's a book I ordered on Amazon, and I'm still waiting for it. I hoped it had arrived at the friends of mine who receive my Amazon things, because I don't get them here because I don't trust the delivery system at my front door. But it hadn't arrived. It's a famous book called something like Germany's War Aims. It's about the First World War. It's by Fritz Fischer, written in 1960 something.
Yeah, something like that.
He would probably put some flesh on the bones of that decision.
If I remember correctly, his essential argument is that there is no real gap between Germany in the First World War and Germany in the Second.
Mm.
It's the same aims, prosecuted by more or less the same means.
Mm.
I think he goes a bit far on that. But the more I know, the more disturbing I think the German militarism becomes. I'll give him that, but...
There's two ways we could elaborate on what we've just said. One is to reflect on assuming we've said what we can about the British decision and how it got made and what it consisted of. The next question is, what about all the Brits who regret this decision and who wish it had been otherwise, who I think still hang around and did hang around? And
Alan Clark, I can remember him doing a documentary in the 90s when he was still... sane, saying, you know, it was a dreadful decision by Churchill in 1940, and we should have, well, presumably just made a deal with the Germans
and hoped for the best. Yes,
and Sean Gabber,
of course,
libertarian in this country, he's dead against what Churchill did.
Absolutely,
I think it's a dreadful mistake. Mm-hmm.
But I'm thinking more of the cultural animus against America. I'm very fond of that line in. Certainly the televised version of Tinker, Tailor, Soldier, Spy, and I can't remember whether it occurs in the film as well, but where the spy, what's his name?
Bill Hayden. The Ian Richardson character.
Yes, the Ian Richardson character. He's got a nosebleed. He's been caught. He's writing checks to his rent boys and, saying to Smiley, please deliver this, and Smiley saying yes. And but in the midst of all this housekeeping, he briefly mentions his motivation, and the line I always remember is, "I hate America very deeply."
Yes, yes, yes. And Suez was also an important part.
Of course.
Yes.
Stabbed in the back by Eisenhower.
I find anti-Americanism deeply disturbing, not least because I think it's a communist plot. I think it's
certainly a communist plot. And I just think it's so silly and ridiculous, you know.
Well, on the basis that America, to most people in the world at most times, is a paradise, and certainly was
exactly.
in, say, 1950.
Mm.
And how dare we criticise it? Yes, indeed.
Mm. I mean, I can remember in the 1950s growing up in drab little Britain, even in the south of England, the affluent suburbs by comparison with most places. I mean, Windsor. At my prep school, posh little place with green cricket pitches and goodness knows what, one of the boys was called, I still remember it, Billy Rogers. He was called Billy. That's a strange thing for a boy to be called Billy. Why wouldn't you be called William? That's what he was christened. But he was called Billy. Why? Because he was an American. His dad was an American Air Force officer. And their car was just mind-boggling. I mean, it was about three times the size of a British car, and it was made of the most extraordinary. The leather seating, I remember that particularly. Out of this world, certainly out of Britain. I mean, there was nothing like it in Britain.
Did it have rockets, did it have tail fins?
It had everything. It was a phenomenal kind of space rocket on wheels. But it was very plush. It had very soggy suspension.
Yeah.
Unlike the sort of clunky stuff we had. And it was just staggering. And then later, influenced by all this, British cars started sprouting junior truncated versions of rockets. You know, yes. Vauxhalls and Fords would start to look a bit like this, but they never really got there.
No.
Never.
No.
I don't think this is a digression. I think this is about the cultural reaction to America that people either have positively or they have another one which is very negative. The ugly American.
You have a line that it's the one thing it most foreigners will say, who do you hate the most, America? And where do you want to live? America.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a well known joke, isn't it? It's one of those Bolshevik jokes that does the rounds. Yes. Yes. But the other thing to be said about anti Americanism of the kind we're talking about is that America's full of it. There are lots of Americans who think that European cars are more civilized and emotionally restrained and better colours, more kind of solemn and proper colours than American sort of purple and yellow and all kinds of crazy things. So there's that kind of anti-Americanism is almost an American export. I mean, consider the slogan of Trump's, "Make America Great Again." Americans are divided into the people who react by going, yeah, and the ones who go, not sure about that, you know?
They're turning into Brits, aren't they?
They have been for a long time.
Yeah.
There's always been this, we're polite, we're civilized, America's a very varied place. I've never been there, but Americans come in all shapes and sizes. Some of them talk fast and loud, some of them talk slow and quiet. They're very, very different from each other, and they have very different feelings about their country. It's a bit strange to call something which is apparently acquiesced to by getting on for half the population as anti-Americanism. I mean, they're Americans, so how can it be that? But
well, they manage it.
It's a strange phenomenon, isn't it?
Yeah.
And all that stuff about vulgar, fat, obese, loud-mouthed Americans with their cameras bouncing around on their tummies shouting at European hoteliers, that you hear from Americans, don't you?
Yes.
I always
think that Fawlty Towers episode, The American, is very revealing, because that crystallises a lot of the feelings that people had about Americans at the time.
Yes.
Incidentally, the actor who's playing the American was a Canadian. But
yeah, there's a lot of that about. Well, the whole Canada-America thing is a sort of subtext of all this, a subplot of all this.
Yeah, the Canadians, in my experience, have exactly the same attitude towards Americans as we. It's
a mixture. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. But there's a very strong strand of anti-Americanism in the British upper classes, in the form of a sort of snobbery.
Yes. Yes.
You know, we've read more Shakespeare plays than that.
I mean, I think it a lot. So much of it goes back to what you were saying about this big American car showing up, and it really is. It's humiliating.
Yes, that's true.
That's it.
Yeah, it's real.
Here we are. We have this empire, and
they beat us. That's what that car says.
What do you think? Well, they beat us economically. Yeah. I think they beat us in some other way.
Well, geopolitically, whatever the word is for that. I mean, the Americans don't have an empire because they didn't want one. That's the reason they don't have one. But we all know they could sort it out in a decade if they wanted a huge empire.
It's all empire.
Go
actually.
Out and buy one.
They don't fuss about it.
They don't fuss about the colour on the maps. But yes, of course.
But,
exactly. And the sort of nagging feeling that they're actually better at it than we are, you know. It's going to last longer, and it's going to count for more. Yes.
I mean, I suppose, for once, I'm having some sympathy with the European Union. Because a part of the European Union is a response to that.
Mm.
The idea that America has this wonderful, wonderfully large internal market, therefore it can foster large and dynamic and enterprises. If we have our internal market, then so will we.
Mm.
And 30 years later, what have we got to show for it?
Well, they were told at the beginning of this that European nations are made of more intractable stuff than American states. And by God, that's true, isn't it? I mean, language, for goodness sake. All talking different languages. The United States of America is fundamentally united by the American, let's call it that, language.
Yes. Well, it's getting to the stage where English is such a lingua franca in Europe that...
Well, you may say it's a lingua franca. Maybe it's a lingua franca, interesting word.
Yes,
of the rulers of Europe. But they're heading for a kind of class war based on language, if they think that, aren't they? They could be in trouble. Arguably, it's already happening.
What do you think?
Well, the Euro elite is hated throughout Europe by the people who don't feel they're part of this project, getting left behind in their little peasant villages, as the people who hate them would say.
Is that right? I think
there's a lot of European kind of, well, nationalism is a polite way of putting it, and not all of it's very nice at all, is it? I mean, in Hungary and places like that, it gets pretty... and why? It's because they feel profoundly that the rulers of Europe are more interested in their own perks and privileges and generally poncing around than they are in the welfare of all the people. Same as Trump, seems to me.
So the rulers of Europe are the same as Trump, or the people of Hungary are the same as
Trump? People of Hungary. Trump's speaking to the same sort of people.
Yes, yes.
And doing it very... By the way, of course, he is the absolute... embodiment of everything that anti-Americans think Americans are and are therefore disgusting.
Loud,
for being
brash,
idiotic,
show
hairdo,
off,
great big paunch,
quite happy with his
fantastically
with
energetic, a taste in oil paintings that is right now doing the rounds on Twitter because he's got one of these oil paintings where you can tell exactly who everybody is, and that the clear implication is that here are about five presidents of the United States, all of whom are good eggs. Well, you can imagine what the artistic community made of that. I mean, they just went.
By the way, did you spot Calvin Coolidge in the background?
Yes. Classic Trump trolling. I mean, absolutely brilliant. Because half of America will say, "Hang on, you're objecting to this oil painting. Why?" Whereas this dismembered rat with a upside down table on top of it in your fucking art gallery. We're supposed to be impressed by that,
yes.
Are we? You know,
yes.
It's brilliant, yes. Culturally. And Trump's culturally is so, so clever. And that's just another way of saying, I love America, all of it. You know, I think it's great, the whole place. Never been there, but maybe I should. Maybe I should wangle a trip there.
I have been to America.
What did you make of it?
I still don't know, because I was, at the time, imbued with quite a lot of anti-Americanism. Which I deeply regret.
Mm.
And I think had I been a bit more of a child about it, I'd have loved it, rather than a sort of snooty adolescent.
Mm. I've got a feeling, I've met a few Americans at sort of classical liberal gatherings where the kind of extreme libertarian thing got me on the receiving end of Christian homilies, which I found pathetic and despicable, mm-hmm. because they were so patronizing. I mean, to be lectured about the nature of science or something by a fundamentalist Christian who talks with the assumption that he's right, whereas...
Well, anyone who talks with the assumption he's right is...
Like, yeah, but a fundamentalist Christian telling you about why you're scientifically wrong, take a hike, you idiot. But...
Without any reference to the scientific method, I presume, or...
Oh, lots of references to it.
Okay.
Well, all about how evidence is the existence of God, or, well, you know. So, I mean, I've got my Americans I don't care for, and I think I might come across quite a lot of those. I don't know, but I suspect that American Christians have got pretty civilized in the last few decades.
Well, I do find it confusing.
And they fight if you pick fights with them, you know.
I mean, you, like I, to say the least, find this Christian stuff really hard to believe. But on the other hand, the Christians are the backbone of America.
Yes.
They are very much Trump's crowd, which I suppose we're both Trump fans.
Mm. Well, Trump himself is not a Christian, which is, if he is, he's a pretty chaotic Christian. Maybe he is. I don't know how you say what a Christian is.
Had that prayer meeting, that pastor he managed to get out of Turkey, so...
Yeah. But he knows how to look after his Christian voters, doesn't he?
Yeah, seems to. Well, I think more to the point, I mean, we're both atheists, and what has atheism got to show for itself? The answer seems to be not a lot.
I think it will achieve its biggest victory against Islam. That's another podcast for us, but because I think atheism in the world of Islam is a very real proposition, more so than in Christianity.
I notice we are getting a long way off the original topic.
Well,
which is fine.
The other way of talking about this decision that the British made, switching right back to what we were talking about in the first 5 minutes of this, is to say that other people have made similar decisions, other great powers. And I offer two. Right. One is Nazi Germany, in the closing stages of the Second World War, could have organised itself very differently.
Yes, we're talking about the Battle of the Bulge here, aren't we?
Battle of the Bulge, all that. The way that Hitler threw his last pile of chips into an attack on the Western Front.
Yes.
Think about how that might have played out differently. Supposing the July 44 plot had succeeded and that bloody table leg hadn't got in the way of the bomb and Hitler had got his just desserts year sooner.
Well, I would, it's counterfactual history, but... The way I look at it is, how many assassinations have ever made the world a better place? And I think the answer is zero.
Ah.
Yes, the assassins may have got what they wanted. I mean, the guys who killed Archduke Franz Ferdinand, they got what they wanted in spades in the end.
Mm.
Although the guy behind it got shot a few years later by his own side. Mm. But generally speaking, assassinations, I cannot think of a single occasion when they've made the world a best
place. Be that as it may, when people say they're going to ignore what's just been said to them. With respect, another one.
Yes.
Suppose that plot had succeeded and the Prussian aristocracy in the army had arranged the affairs of Germany from then on. They presumably would have contacted the Allies and say, we want to surrender to the Americans and to the Brits, but not to the Russians. And the Americans and the Brits, or the Americans especially, Roosevelt would have said, take a hike. We're going to carry on fighting.
Yes.
You surrender to all of us.
Yes.
That, I think, is what would have happened. Even if Churchill might have said, oh, that would have been nice. but what if the Germans had then held the Russians as best they could?
Mm-hmm.
And when the Americans and the British attacked in the West, they said, be our guest, come in. In you come, yes.
There is just one point, is that is logistics here, is that any nation fighting essentially fights around a centre. Because in order to fight, certainly the Second World War, you need your, I was going to say oil, but actually Germany didn't have any oil by the end, but you need your infrastructure, you need your factories, there's various supply depots of food. And ultimately, actually, if you lose those things, you can't fight at all.
Mm.
So,
well, what
Germany, I'm proposing, essentially, what I'm saying,
what I'm proposing is that the Germans would would have wanted to surrender to the Western allies, mm-hmm. and they yes. would have yeah. contrived a situation where, in effect, they did. And they'd have had the whole war settled by autumn 1944, you know.
Yeah.
It would all have been done in a couple of months, because there'd have been no Arnhem and no Battle of the Teutoburger Wald or whatever it was when they were fighting their way through Germany. None of that. And they'd have just held the Russians as best they could and let the Allies have their country. Let the Western Allies have their country, sorry. And the Russians would have... Stalin would have snarled and raged, and that's what he was afraid of, surely. All the time. Now, that's an example of a number three that knows it's beaten, or is clearly in trouble, in effect deciding who's going to win of the two winning teams.
Yeah. Well, I suppose the Russians did better than they might have expected, but yeah. Well, I suppose it was pretty even, Stephen, from what 45 to maybe 85, wasn't it? And then it became apparent actually one of these sides is rather. I mean, when I was growing up, it was obvious that we were richer in the West than they were in the East.
Yeah, they still haven't built any cars like those 1950s American cars in Russia. They got some a bit like it, but. Yeah, mostly bad fakes. Yeah. Zills, I think they were called.
Yes.
That's one example of a declining power making a decision of which rising power it will support.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we should name the guilty party. It was Hitler who decided this. It wasn't Germany. And Hitler was revealing himself to be the enemy of Germany in the process of doing this. That's why there was no Hitler movement after the war, because the Germans worked out he was their number one enemy.
Yes.
Hitler's attitude was, Germany has betrayed me, so fuck it. Yeah. That was what he thought by the end, well before the war ended.
It was well before. I mean, I know that he sort of said that this sort of thing he rats about in the bunker, but I didn't realise he was saying that.
Well, I mean, his attitude was, Germany's either going to win the world or not. Those are the choices.
Mm.
Typical on-off Hitler attitude.
Yes.
So the Germans knew that he was their enemy long before the end of the war, and this decision exemplified that. Another example of the same decision brings it right up to date, because it's arguably in the process of being made right now, and that is Russia deciding between America and China. I wonder what you think of that as a comparison.
Well, I don't think it's going to happen, because I think there's life in the old dog yet, and I think the really spectacular thing about the West is it invents things. China has never invented anything. I mean, the Japanese, who started this process a long, long way before China, I can't think of anything. They've improved on things. They invented the bullet train, which is an improvement on an existing technology.
They've improved lots of things.
Yeah.
They improved televisions, laser printers, the whole works.
Did they improve them, or did they just... get very good at making them. I suppose. I mean, the sheer process.
Isn't that the same
manufacture
thing?
Is improvement.
Yeah.
Maybe.
I think just organizing industry, the Japanese have proved themselves to be world class, haven't they?
Yes. Didn't do them much good in the battlefield because they were behind.
I mean, they weren't doing it then, were they? They were concentrating on their army and.
Oh no! There were lots of Zaibatsus at the time. I mean, things like Datsun.
And you have also, unlike me, been to Japan, haven't you?
Yes.
You've got connections in Japan.
Yes. So I.
Well, that's another one. I mean, you could argue that Japan faced a similar dilemma, China or America, and they've after the Second World War they went with the Americans pretty solidly, didn't they? And they're now in the process of ratifying that decision and reinforcing
it.
Yes,
they are. Yes, it would appear. Maybe.
What this thinking about this kind of decision made by a declining power in favour of one superior power or another is to think, I wonder how often this has happened in history.
Well, you'd think it must have happened many a time in Europe. Because you think of all the sort of various countries that have risen and fallen, like, well, obviously Britain and Spain and France, well, Germany. Did anyone make a contribution to... There was no outside party, for instance, in the Franco-Prussian War, to the best of my knowledge. Although Antoine Clark, our friend, will say that actually the French were expecting the British to come in on their side.
Yes.
A little bit peeved when they didn't.
Because
obviously that was a disaster. Well, often for the French.
If you're expected to join in and you don't, that is a sort of that's a decision of obviously in its own right,
yes.
isn't it?
Yes.
Yes, Napoleon III was very pro-British and had done lots of pro-British kind of bonding.
Yeah.
It didn't count for much, did it? It would appear.
No.
And the Franco-Prussian War was absolutely cataclysmic for France, wasn't
yes.
it?
Yes.
It was
in all sorts of ways.
To me, it makes the debacle of 1940 all too understandable. Whereas it makes
it does.
The,
yeah.
Yes. Whereas it makes the 19 the First World War performance of France remarkable.
Well, they got beaten. That's the big problem.
But they did. They gave, as the saying goes, a good account of themselves, didn't they?
In
the First World War, the French.
Yes, but I was thinking about 1870 or 1940. They got beaten. They got beaten on the battlefield.
Oh, in 1940, they got slaughtered. Yes.
Again, Antoine will say. I mean, you will go into villages in France, and you will find a little monument.
Mm.
To some unit who fought to the death in 1940.
Absolutely. Yeah.
They lost a lot of men trying to fight.
Oh, yes.
They were beaten. And
yeah.
it's as simple as that.
I mean, in Brittany, I found all sorts of war memorials covered with the same surnames. You know, that shows you they were fighting.
This is 40 or...
40.
40.
Mm.
Wow.
Oh, yes. I mean, and I remember seeing a play set in 1940 France,
yeah.
Where exactly the sort of battle you're talking about took place between some French and the French fought to the death.
Yeah.
And at one point during this, not surprisingly, one of the French guys said to another French guy, "Why are we doing this?" And the answer is because we're chasseurs.
Yes.
Almost like the concluding spasms of Waterloo. You know, the famous sort of, whether it ever happened like that, I don't know, but he spat on the ground and said, "Come and get us," you know, the final stand of the...
Is that a bit where the troops withdraw to reveal a whole bunch of cannon, and the cannons fire just to wipe these people off? Is that all right?
I don't know what happened afterwards, but they died.
Yes, yes.
But, it you know, it's the stuff of oil paintings, isn't it?
Anyway, so where do we get to? Do we agree that the French did actually try quite hard in all the wars they fought?
We're giving the French the credit for having stuck at it,
mm-hmm.
Having a resilient military culture.
I think we were trying to think of other examples where the number three has been important in European history. I was thinking about the 30 Years' War, but as I remember, that was pretty inconclusive, and there were quite a lot of number threes who got dragged in, including
quite a lot
Britain
of,
at various
quite similar. A lot of medieval English situations where the number threes were the Scots.
Yes.
Very complicated. I'm reading about that now. But those were my... that was my sort of one of my thoughts apropos of this British decision, was have there been other decisions like it? You seem to agree with me that there probably have been lots. And we thought of a few, but
not too sure about that. But anyway, yes.
Either we could stop now, or we could reflect on what I think is interesting, which is the way that this decision made by the British is continuing to reverberate. And we got onto that with the discussion of, you know, Clark talking about Churchill's decision and all that.
Mm-hmm.
The historian, politician, Alan Clark.
Well, it might amongst historians, but does it?
Well, I think it still reverberates. I mean, I attended the Trump demo, the anti-Trump, the one with that ridiculous little...
The blimp.
Blown-up blimp, yes. And I also attended not the anti-Brexit march that was on Saturday. Was it Saturday? But certainly a day or two ago.
Yes.
But I attended an earlier anti-Brexit march when they had just recovered from the shock of losing the referendum, and they decided to have a march saying, "No!" And they did seem very alike in tone.
Oh, to the...
to each other.
The anti...
The pro-EU one and the anti-Trump one.
Right, yes.
And I don't know if I've got photographs to prove it, but I would imagine there are some banners that did duty in both demos.
Well, I mean, for reasons we were discussing earlier in the
time.
It's competition for...
It seems to me that... one of the things I learned when I attended the and the first anti-Brexit demo was how utterly, completely convinced they are that the Brexiteers are all racist.
Yes.
That I told one of these demonstrators I'd voted for Brexit, and by God, the temperature plummeted at that point. I mean, it really turned nasty. Yes. I was surprised. I thought it was a disagreement, but no, this was a real... There was real venom from then on.
I mean, we could talk about...
I mean,
about,
they controlled
We could
it.
Talk about post-Brexit
I wasn't
for
assaulted.
Hours and hours.
I wasn't assaulted, but mm-hmm. I was threatened in an oblique manner, which became less and less oblique. And I because I didn't see it coming, it took a while for me to realise what they were saying, which was, fuck off, you cunt. That's what they were saying.
Mm-hmm.
They hated me and everything about me.
Yes.
I think it's because they confuse racism with something similar, which is culturalism, whatever you call it. It seems to me that racism is very distinct from the claim that British culture is better than somebody else's culture. And it's also very, above all, it's very different from the claim, well, British culture, I don't know whether it's better than other people's cultures, but it's our culture and we want to stay with it. We're used to it. We like it. We'll keep it, thank you. Which is a distinct claim from this proposition that ours is better than France or Germany or something like that. I mean, I think it is better than Russia politically. I think the political culture of Russia is really toxic and has been for a very long time.
Well, I sort of say, well, you know, where would you have wanted to live over the last 1,000 years if you could choose a place but you can't change tell the year? You're going to be...
And you can't tell what rank you're going to be in.
No.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, it's going to be Britain. I mean, it might be the Netherlands, as long as you don't get involved in the war with the Spanish.
Or late 1944.
Well, yes, that's pretty bad. It ain't America for most of that time, because it's, you know, prairie. Italy, perhaps. They did quite a lot of good things. But... You really don't want to get involved in, say, the 30 Years' War or, you know, Russia pretty much any time. France and the Revolution.
I read a very entertaining book about the Wars of the Roses recently by a man called John Gillingham. I read it because there was somebody called John Gillingham who went to my prep school, but he's a different guy. That same prep school with the American guy. And he points out that you can tell that England was a very peaceful society compared to the continent. And this is man writing about the Wars of the Roses, remember?
Yeah.
The word peace appears in the subtitle of the book.
Oh, in what?
His point being that the Wars of the Roses were nothing compared to what used to go on the continent. And the proof is the physical fortifications of English towns, which are nothing compared to what you see on the continent of the same period.
Really?
I mean, they don't have these...
I mean, so we're not exactly short of castles in this country.
Oh, no, so they were built by... they're talking about...
The fortifications of the towns,
yes.
As opposed to the castles.
Yes.
But London had a wall.
Yeah,
Londonderry still has its wall,
says,
by the way.
He says that the thing that walls in England mostly did was collect taxes. They meant that you could only get into the city through one gate, and there you could be fleeced for whatever it was. Whereas... On the continent, there are these enormous ziggy-zaggy circles.
Oh, it was real proper.
And we don't have those.
Yes.
And they started being built at that time. It was the beginnings of gunpowder. What it was that it was pretty soon discovered that you had to have your own cannons if you were going to defend a city. And you couldn't do that by just parking the cannons in the walls. You had to have them on kind of promontories outside the walls. And that was the way to do it.
That's vulnerable.
I know, but it apparently, I can't remember why, but this was what they all decided to do. And you had things like, Gillingham describes a city, not a particularly big one. I think it was Nantes in the kind of French end of Brittany, so to speak, which made a decision that they were going to have better fortifications for their town. And they spent about a year and a half.
I wonder who they thought they were going to be attacked by.
Well,
us,
King of France.
Oh,
you remember
Brittany
that
was...
France wasn't a united enterprise at that point.
Oh,
French king, the English kings were all going at each other, and local potentates would join in on whatever, you know, lots of number three activity going on in that part of the world. And it was like that all over Europe. And you see these... I mean, one of the great things I did recently by sheer fluke, again, mentioning Antoine Clark, our friend, he was living in Paris in a flat, and I think he still is. And I visited him in the freezing February of, I think, 2012 or 13. And by absolute gorgeous fluke, there was an exhibition of models of French fortifications going on in one of their very grand museums.
Oh, wow.
Absolutely freezing cold, and I wasn't feeling my best. But this wonderful, wonderful exhibition of model after model after model in fantastic detail. I mean, just wonderfully done. And these were used to train staff officers to fight French battles. And this enterprise of building these models went on for several centuries. So there were some from sort of 1400, 1500, that kind of thing, way up to the 19th century and even, I think, into the 20th century.
Well, when I was an officer cadet, we had to use models. I never understood why. I do now.
How good were they?
Well, because we didn't understand what we was doing, they were rubbish. But
in the
First World War.
But I mean, would they have looked pretty on TV and in photographs, or would they have looked a bit naff? Because these were fabulous. These were model railway masterpieces.
Oh no, not like that. I mean, the models would tend to get used on a platoon level are just for the night, so they're very, very basic.
Mm.
In the First World War, certainly by 1917 at Passchendaele, the British Army was using very large scale models, so that everyone now is this every officer or every soldier, probably just the officers, could walk through the battlefield and see where the trenches were and where the barbed wire. Well, obviously the barbed wire should be wiped out by the time you're crossing the no-man's land, and what the features were. So when you're actually on the ground, you knew where you were and where everyone else was supposed to be.
In Sandhurst or somewhere, there is an enormous treasure trove of just such models that army officers know all about and I know nothing about.
But the whole problem about warfare is you can't do it for real very often.
And also for the British officers, you never know where you're going to be doing it. Whereas French officers, it's all too likely you're going to be doing it in France. You know, that's going to be where it is. And so therefore you can afford to concentrate on making a fantastic, incredibly accurate model of some Eastern French city.
I wonder if this is to do with something you were saying, because you were reading a book, I think, about Roger Mortimer, forgive me. But the point you made was that we think of the English Channel as a moat, but for many centuries it was a highway.
That's right.
And
that's right.
We really haven't been under the great threat of an invasion since the Spanish Armada.
But invasions were constant before that.
Before that. So the fact...
They were routine.
The point being that British towns did not need fortifications because the Royal Navy was the fortification.
There were a few on the south coast that were... fortified in the continental manner.
Yes, Dover. And really quite recently as well, actually. There's the Royal Military Canal in just by Dover and in Hythe. And, yes.
That's where we get a whiff of what the whole of France was like.
Yes.
And the Wars of the Roses, they were battles, but, I mean, one of them was just a fight in the high street of some town. I can't remember which one was.
Barnet or St Albans?
I think so, yes. Yeah. I think it may have been. You know, in France, that wouldn't be a fight. That would be a Saturday afternoon. You know, that would be the home.
Well, I think we should. I mean, Toton was a
there were a few
20,000.
Well, there were a few right old Barneys, but there weren't any sieges of any huge note because there just weren't. They couldn't afford the time. They didn't have enough money to sustain a campaign. Therefore, they had pitched battles.
This is at a time when gunpowder isn't so powerful it can destroy any fortification or any castle. Mm. And there are plenty of castles around. So yes, it is a bit of a surprise.
Anyway, all of this reinforces your point that Britain was a much nicer place to live than lots of others.
Yes.
And therefore, you know, this country with its 1,000 years of relatively better, maybe just lucky, who knows,
yes,
I mean, lucky because of the sea and all that, you know, John of Gaunt, blah, blah. Why should we attach ourselves?
The Sceptre Dial, is that? Is
yeah, that one. Right. It serves it in the office of a wall and all that. The silver sea set in us. That one.
Right, okay.
Why would we want to be a province of Europe? Mainland Europe? And you can see why those people who called me a racist shit in almost those words would they are conflating that feeling about British history and British institutions and the resulting
the feeling that
we have a distinct political tradition which is fine, and what's the problem with it that we need to join the EU, for God's sake? You know, if we're Greece or if we're Malta or something, yes, or now post-communist Slovakia or somewhere like that, I can understand why you might think that joining the EU might solve some local problems big time.
Yes.
But what local problems does joining the EU solve for Britain? None. The only one I've ever heard mentioned is that we have... No, that was a different one. It was about the reorganisation of local... But no, I don't think there are any British problems that are solved by joining the European Union. Mention any problem and we can solve it. We can sort it out ourselves.
I can imagine here I speaking up for the European Union. I think it has solved airlines quite well.
Yes. But do you really think we had to join the European Union to sort out airlines?
Actually, I do. I don't think it's a price worth paying for that advantage. But yes,
do you think
I understand the EU has done two very valuable things. First of all, it has stuffed the flag carriers, which means that EasyJet and Ryanair can do their business. The other thing is that for years and years there was no agreement between the British and the Americans over flying rights.
Mm.
And the EU stepped in, took Britain's responsibility, said, right, anyone can... And got an agreement done.
Mm.
I think that's how it happened. Mm. And there do seem to be more choices when it comes to...
Mm.
Yes, the EU has made it easier for Britons and Americans to speak to one another. Well done, Brussels!
Yeah, well, that's good. I'm glad to hear that. Yes,
it's brought the atmosphere together.
I have heard that sort of thing said, and I've forgotten it. But I suppose it's imaginable that we would have still had to pay £150 to go to Spain or something. Anyway, what I'm getting at is that the kind of, you know, the long continuity of our institutions, I think Churchill called it in one of his 1940s speeches, that mentality, which I am absolutely part of, immersed in, is described by many as English racism, and I think that's a slander.
Yes,
I think racism means looking at the biological makeup of the person you're talking to and saying you're not allowed to be part of this or us, you know.
Mm-hmm.
That's what it means. And I think one of the things I like about the long continuity of our institutions is that we don't do that. Anyone who wants to can join in. The Anglosphere, absolutely at the heart of the idea of the Anglosphere, is that anyone can join. You might have some language lessons to get to grips with, but you know, the idea that you would be racially excluded, nonsense. This is a vision of how the world could be that is distinct from other visions, which are equally non-racist but are deeply cultural, which you get from other cultures. I mean, Islam. I have my vehement objections to Islam, but it's not racist.
This bunch of Arabs hates that bunch of Arabs and so on. I mean, the local rights.
Well, you get local cultural spats galore, but Islam itself is not racist.
No.
No way.
No.
And hating Islam is not racist either. It's hating what it says.
Yes.
And that business of conflating real and defensible and meaningful and intelligent and civilized cultural disagreements. You know, we went off on a tangent talking about France and how it did things and did things differently to us, maybe. And a Frenchman might have heard us doing that and would have said, oh, hang on, you've got this wrong, or something else happened. But that doesn't mean he's calling us racist, and it doesn't mean we're calling him a racist. And we're not calling him a member of a different race, for that matter.
Yes.
And I think that's very important. But I think a lot of Brexiters were nervous. The exception would be Daniel Hannan. Were nervous about saying this kind of thing. The recent extreme version of this is people calling Churchill a racist. And I think they did that not just because of things he did to coloured people, but also because of his talk about the English-speaking people and the history of the, you know, he wrote a whole multi-page, multi-volume history of the English-speaking people, didn't he?
Wasn't he? I mean, he wasn't. Weren't most people in those days?
Mm.
I mean, if you looked at the world,
yes, I suppose.
1900, and you said, well, you know, almost everywhere there are white people, it's prosperous. And
yes, but the, if you dig into the details of what people think about those things, it's because of cultural differences rather than, it's not caused by biology.
No,
it sort of maps with biology in a way that's easily confused with thinking that it's biology that's at the root of it. But in that sense, I don't think Churchill was a racist, was he? Maybe he was.
I don't know. I mean, I haven't.
It seems to me that racism comes in lots of different kind of degrees, and near the worst bits is the claim that there's a causal force in the form of biology, which makes certain people incapable of certain attitudes or feelings or discoveries or forms of civilised behaviour.
The statement that, on average, people will be different is a lot less contentious, I think.
Yeah, and you're not saying why. And you're not saying why. I mean, it's history. It's how things turned out. But I think that the Brexiters were frightened. I think, let me put it this way. Supposing I'd said all this on Question Time,
mm-hmm.
which I wouldn't, but supposing I'd attempted it, half the audience would have gone out convinced I was a racist, a National Fronter at best. And therefore, people with opinions like the ones I've just tried to express have been hesitant to do so. There was a lot of silent arm folding by the Brexit team, I think, going, I know what I think and I'm not going to talk about it with you, thank you very much, because I know what you're going to call me if I do.
Yes.
That happened a lot.
But they still won.
Mm-hmm.
Despite all that. Or maybe because of it, I don't know.
Well, we won a great victory in the referendum, a great battle.
Yes,
and there's still more battles to be fought, and metaphorically speaking, and we shall see. I remain optimistic. I think we're going to shake ourselves free of it, mostly because I think the European Union is in such a bad way. But we'll see. We've got a long way from the original agenda, haven't we?
Just as usual.
Yes.
As usual.
I think
we're not. This isn't an interview, is it? It's, you
know, I mean, it might be a good time for me to say that what I like about these conversations is that it is enough for me that there might be somebody listening. That alone is enough to give a kind of a kind of it kind of pulls together the conversation. It's very hard to have a conversation as deep as the one we've just had, I think,
mm-hmm.
if we're just in a, you know, just talking.
Yeah.
Well,
we can. I think one of the advantages is we're actually sat down for a while, so we've got to.
If
the telephone
bit
rings, you're going to put it down. If the door goes, you're going to ignore it or talk.
But under what circumstances would we sit down with such single-mindedness?
Yes, indeed.
If there were not a recording device, I think it's unlikely. And it's the quality of the conversation I relish. That's why I like doing these things. And if nobody's listening, well, I'm a bit disappointed, but I'm not I'm not heartbroken.
Nice.
As far as I'm concerned, if anybody listens and has something lucid to add, that's a cherry on the cake. But the cake is the fun of the conversation.
Mm.
So once again, thank you very much for organising the recording device.
Okay, you want to finish there?
I feel that we've probably said.
Yeah.
I mean, have you?
There's nothing I
let me just look through the. No, I've covered all the things I had on my little scribbling.
Well, let's at the very least take a break, and it might be a permanent one, so let's do that.
All right.